York, deep in the middle of nowhere. Our host, Parhija Nahal, I bring you the AT Estrogen Podcast Show and the topics that two dames think we really need to discuss.
Hello, everybody. This is going to be our second AT Estrogen Show. Parhija and I have been through hell, fire, and brimstone. We're almost certain that it's a conspiracy laid out by Skeptic Overlord and Springer to try to kill us. I've been through 14 days of flu or cold or sinus infection, and then they threw the dreaded mumpolates on Parhija. She's been mumpolated since, like, Monday or something. But we are recovering. And we are going to survive. We will survive. Okay. The very first thing we would like to do is, first of all, give a great big thank you to everybody that replied on our first podcast thread. It was great to get feedback from you guys and to see that we had brought up some issues that concerned other members. And so it really put some depth to it. Special thank you to Fred T, who happens to be the medical forums FSME, and he was very passionate about the topic of SSRIs and the negative effect they're having on people and how they're being misprescribed, under moderated. And we had several members who came forward and gave personal accounts of how either they themselves have been put on these medicines and had negative experiences, or they know somebody really close to them who has gone through it. And we really appreciate that. I decided to share my personal experience on these medicines, and that was a tough decision to do. And it really made it easier once I saw that other people were willing to share their experiences. So thank you very much. On today's show, we are going to try to give you some updates on several of the stories that we talked about in our first show. And the first story that we want to update on is the Weiss story, and Parhija's going to tell you what she has found.
Well, when we tried to do our AT Estrogen number 2 show last Monday, so it was about a week ago, we found an article that kind of shed some light on the story, because it had a speculation of what Louis Jourdain, who's the son of the Red Lake tribal chairman, was charged with, and they speculated that he was charged with conspiracy to commit murder. And before we did the show tonight, we did a little bit more research and came across an article that is called Teen Pleads Guilty to Role in Shootings. And the story just got more interesting because it says he admits to using the internet inappropriately, and he pled guilty to a charge of threatening interstate communications, which we're not quite
sure. We don't know what that means.
No, not at all. But he pled guilty to that. But two other charges against him were dropped, the first of which is the conspiracy to commit murder, and the second is the conspiracy to commit offenses against the United States. Again, we don't really know what that last one means. But the fact that these were dropped is very interesting, because a lot of things really aren't answered still. We don't know what his involvement was. How did he use the internet wrongly? And what offenses was he going to commit against the United States? Why was he charged with these to begin with? What was his role in this tragedy? 'Cause it seems that, you know, contrary to the early stories about him not being really the same, hanging in the same type of group that Jeff Weiss did, it seems that they were closer than was first reported. And I think having these things released just, you know, makes us ask more questions and be more curious about his involvement in this, and whether, you know, the sole responsibility should be left on the, you know, the shoulders of Jeff Weiss, because, you know, this doesn't really answer anything, even though we do know what he was charged with. Why were these charges dropped, and why was he charged with them to begin with? We'll have to keep following it and see what else we can come up with, because we're certainly more curious now than we were before.
That's so true, because what was it? Threatening offenses against the United States?
Yeah, conspiracy to commit offenses against the United States.
And then that's just dropped, so yeah. That's kind of odd.
And really, what does it mean to begin with? What does one do to get charged with conspiracy to commit offenses against the United States? And the thing is that the court docket, which was released, had quite a bit of information still blacked out. So it says that it said in the docket that he used the computer to conduct interstate communications that, quote, could be taken by an objective observer as threatening, unquote, sometime between January 1st, 2003 and March. So that doesn't really answer anything, and it also kind of makes us wonder, the people who are on the internet quite regularly, what do you do to, you know, during your time online that could be considered threatening? Especially on a website like AboveTopSecret.com, it's, you know, there's a lot of touchy subjects being addressed. So it just kind of makes you wonder, like, could you be charged for something that you're doing online? Especially, you look at this, and he was let off of these charges. So, you know, how serious was what he was doing? And it seems in this day and age that a lot of very, very minor, insignificant things can land you in trouble. So,
one of the other stories that that we had discussed last time we met was about the tsunami, and we actually have two different updates on that. The first one is about the children. Parisia had asked the questions about, you know, how are the children doing? Are they being taken care of? We had heard the rumors of child trafficking and pedophiles in the works and all of that. And so I was able to find an article in USA Today that it was actually a fresh story before we were attacked by Skeptic Overlord and Springer with these foul viruses that they threw on us. But now it's kind of dated. But you're going to have to live with it.
If you have any problems, take it up with them.
That's right. This story is actually a revisit. Apparently, USA Today went over to Sri Lanka, and Sri Lanka was hit, I want to say, second to Indonesia, really. They really suffered. They had about 30,000 people die from the tsunami, and around 500,000 people left homeless on the eastern and southwestern coasts. USA Today went over there in January of last year, and they found a 14-year-old girl and her two brothers who had been left orphans by the tsunami, and they did a human interest story on these children. And so they just went back approximately 10 months later to see how these children were faring. Now, all three children have remained in government children's homes. They have a half-sister who is 26, but she's a factory worker, and she actually lives in a government dormitory that's crowded, and it didn't afford her any way to take in her half-sister and her half-brothers. They got with her and talked to her a little bit about how she felt her half-siblings were doing, and she actually said that they are doing better now than they were doing prior to the tsunami. Apparently, they were never made to go to school before. Their family was extremely poor. They didn't have good diets. So they're now attending school. They look a lot healthier because of their better diet. And the girl who lives in a government girls' home with approximately 30 other girls. She's actually given a monthly allowance by the government, and I'm assuming that the boys are also given this. She's given the equivalent of 10 American dollars a month, and the article points out that that's actually pretty good, considering that the average worker's monthly salary is around $50 a month, and she's already saved up $300, and she's going to continue to save, because when she turns 18, she will, of course, have to move out, and her long-term goal is to be able to reunite with her brothers. And there's some statistics given in this that are pretty amazing. 180,000 people is what this is listing as the approximate dead total in the tsunami toll. And of course, Indonesia is at the top with 131,000 dead there. Then Sri Lanka with around 31,000. And India was third with almost 11,000. In Sri Lanka, it's saying that at this point, all of the debris has been cleared, but thousands of homeless Sri Lankans are still living in these little ad hoc shacks that were thrown up after the tsunami. And apparently, the funds that were supposed to go for construction of new homes has been tied up due to, and I quote, bureaucratic wrangling and controversy. And in addition, things have been slowed down because of the conflict with the Tamil Tiger rebels in Oz. The good news on this is that there were approximately 900 Sri Lankan children left homeless, and all but 10 of those have been taken into homes by their relatives. And another good thing to report is that it was found that the reports of child trafficking and pedophiles to abduct children, those reports were exaggerated. Now, there were some isolated, there was one incident where they found that a volunteer worker in a specific children's home, in fact, had a record of child molestation, and they quickly got him out of the system. And ever since then, the government has stayed very vigilant to make sure that inappropriate people are kept away from these children. And so I think that's some fairly good news for the concerns we had on some of the children.
It is. But, it's very good to hear that they're being taken care of, and that, especially regarding the human trafficking issue, that it was largely exaggerated. That's really good to hear.
But I understand you've learned some things over about Indonesia that aren't as positive.
Yes. As we addressed or briefly brought up in the last AT Estrogen, we talked about bird flu and its emergence in Indonesia and how the ravaged infrastructure would affect the dealing with this. And this evening we were searching around and found that bird flu has been detected in Indonesia's Aceh province. And this is the province that was hit the worst. I believe approximately 150,000 people died in that province, and another 500,000 were left homeless. And in this province, there are still tens of thousands of people still living in crowded refugee camps following the tsunami. So that's especially worrisome. Well, bird flu is still at the point where it's human-to-human transmission is still happening very rarely, but in those conditions, in refugee camp conditions, which are generally appalling, it's the perfect breeding ground for any disease, much less an influenza disease that is extremely deadly. And, you know, given the opportunity, that's a perfect opportunity, and basically what we warned of last week that could happen. There was another article I found that said, okay, it destroyed 90% of the public infrastructure there. So, while it says that most of the chickens have been culled, we've seen in the past, well, over the past 2 years, that Thailand, Vietnam, they've all culled as many chickens as they could, but they couldn't get rid of the virus. So that's really not that much of a relief for me to hear that most of the chickens have been culled, because, as we've seen, it still keeps popping back up. And with in a province that has tens of thousands of people still living in refugee camps, with 90% of the infrastructure destroyed 11 months ago, how much of that can be built back, and how adequately can this be dealt with? Because it really is a big concern. This is something I'll be watching closely.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you found that article, because this is really concerning. I hope the WHO is staying on top of this. And what I mean by this is the Banda Aceh area, because, you know, we've been hearing the things around Jakarta, the more urban areas of Indonesia, mm-hmm. but we haven't been hearing anything about this, about Aceh, and it was wiped out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just scoured by the tsunami.
And with the refugee areas, it's basically another urban area. People are living so closely together, and without, you know, basic sanitation and stuff like that, you know, refugee camps generally don't have the best sanitation. What can happen?
I know. It's scary.
It is, and I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to keep up with that. We're going to keep up with WEIS. And we've got a couple of new things we're going to keep up with. I believe kind of same genre as story. Mm-hmm. You have some concerns about Pakistan and Kashmir.
Well, yeah, and, you know, concerns as well as just, you know, bringing it back into the consciousness again. Because I found an article called Kashmir's Earthquake, Don't Care or Don't Know. And I think that adequately describes it. People either don't care or they don't know about it because it's not being covered. And there's a lot of interesting statistics that I found with regard to this earthquake and the fact that winter is coming, and people have already started dying of the cold. Three people died of the cold last week, and it's bound to get worse because it's not the best area to be living in after an earthquake and being homeless in refugee camps in the middle of winter. But aside from that, there's some numbers. Approximately 270,000 people died in the Asian tsunami of last year, December 26th. And so far from this earthquake, approximately 100,000 people have died. And there's over 3.3 million people who are homeless. And again, this is homeless in sub-zero weather in the mountains. Very, very cold. But what I found to be, well, heartbreaking was the fact that approximately, well, about 50% of those people who are homeless are children. And the fact that the aid is barely trickling in, and they haven't gotten near an appropriate amount of aid. The Asian tsunami generated about $10 billion in disaster relief, but the Pakistani earthquake has only gotten about $630 million so far, and a lot of that is not getting there to begin with. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons for this. Skeptic Overlord brought up in his latest podcast the whole thing about donor fatigue and people using money for the wrong things. And he's right. You know, there have been a lot of disasters in the past year, and people have given so much, and that's wonderful. But there are still people, approximately 1.5 million children in Pakistan and Kashmir who don't have the aid that they need, and they're in refugee camps, and they don't have the aid that they need. They're not getting the need, their needs met. And there are other reasons for it, too. Pakistan and India have had an ongoing conflict for a long time. They both have nuclear weapons, and there's always been a little bit of uncertainty about the situation, and also the fact that Kashmir is a disputed region that's been, you know, having conflict, armed conflict for many years as well. And then there's the whole corrupt government issue again, probably playing into this. If we give our money, is it really going to get to the people that we're giving it to? Or is it going to line somebody else's pocket who doesn't really need it? So it really is a tragic and hard situation, because people are left in a position where there are no easy answers. You know, we all want to help, but are we really helping the people we mean to by giving money or lining someone else's pocket? Or can we even afford to give? You know, it's the holiday season, there's lots of expenses, and, you know, either way it's understandable, but it's just something that we need to realize is going on. People are out in the cold, and the money that has been given isn't necessarily getting there, so it is a problem.
And you know something else that I think about on this story? I don't know how to say this properly, but I hope that the Middle Eastern countries have stepped up for Pakistan, and I wonder if they have because of their partnership, if you will, in the war on terrorism with the U.S. I wonder if there has been a little less support, and maybe that's something we can check into.
I think that's definitely something we should check into, because that's a whole other issue, right? You know, depending on the condemning the West when everything's relatively okay, but then when something happens, you know, give me money, damn it.
Yeah.
You know? So
please.
Well, exactly. So, you know, and I guess it's the whole other thing, you know, are we responsible for our fellow humans?
And we are.
A lot of people struggle with that question, and I think we are, but then there's the whole other dimension of, you know, damn you, and then, you know, I'm hurting, please help me.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people take issue with that, and, you know, hopefully move beyond it, because we all have our opinions and all that, but when we're in need, and
that's
like
right.
Said,
humanity should come first.
And like I said, 50% of those homeless are children. What did they do?
Right.
So,
well, we'll keep up with that story too, and hopefully, we'll find out that things are being handled properly. It's not. This kind of story is not something that you can say, you know, a month from now, everything should be fixed.
No.
It's a story where you just have to look into whether, like you said, when the aid gets there, is it being used properly?
And how much of our money is getting there?
Right. And it gets filtered. Somebody skims off the top in every organization that touches it.
Yep.
And just like in Sri Lanka, you know, they have the funds. They have for 10 months they were going to build the new homes, and they're still arguing about where they're going to build them. And that's pathetic. Go out and walk around the tent cities and see that you have people that need a home. They need plumbing. They need to be out of the elements.
They need their basics.
Yeah. I am going to switch gears majorly.
Okay.
And this next story is kind of in the what the category. I wrote an article back a few months ago that was entitled "The Dirty Bomb at Our Doorstep." And I went over the National Regulatory Commission, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's database over the past, I don't remember how many years. Anyway, I did an average number of radioactive devices that are lost every year and not recovered. And it was fairly alarming. And I'll put a link to that in our thread in case anybody wants to visit that.
And we can put reference links to everything so it makes it easier, because people did ask last time. So.
Yeah. And what started as just another, oh, by the way, we have a little bit of radioactive material gone story on the 16th of November has now gradually become more bizarre. This has to do with two vials of antimony 124, and it's not the amount of radioactive material that's gone, it's the bizarreness in how it came up missing, or even how it got shipped. It was shipped from New Mexico, from Albuquerque, and it was headed to Kilgore, Texas. Now, get a load of this. These two vials were placed in a World War II-style ammo box that weighs 80 pounds, and then that was stuffed in an unmarked drum. So, you just kind of, I don't know, garage sell this stuff into a drum. You don't follow any hazardous material requirements, any DOT or EPA requirements, and it gets sent down the road. And the story was updated around a week later that, of course, the FBI has become involved in this in trying to help both Texas and New Mexico figure out where the hell this stuff went. The investigators now believe that it was stolen someplace in Texas before it got to Kilgore. But the odd thing about this, Parisia, is that if this thing was stolen off of that truck, it just almost has to be an inside job with the trucking company. Mm-hmm. The information has to come off the manifest, because the drum wouldn't have been of interest. It wasn't marked in any way that would have made it attractive. They didn't know even about an outsider. I mean, if they broke into the truck, they would not know that there was a World War II ammo box inside the drum. So it wasn't like an antique collector thief.
Right.
And so this is kind of bizarre. And of course, the Federal Bureau of Insults got involved, the same one that wants us to believe that an American Airlines plane was almost shot down by a bottle rocket. And they say, due to the small amount of antimony 124 involved, the materials are not considered a terrorist threat. Well, thank you.
That's not the point.
Somebody went to great pains to remove a drum that should not have been even attractive to anybody that contained radioactive material. And I'm going to try to keep up with this. It's probably another one of those deals where, you know, you hear a tanker truck's been stolen and you never hear anything about it again. But
we definitely need to keep up with it. And I don't know if you saw it, but it says there's still some degree of possibility that it wasn't packed in Albuquerque in the first place, which really speaks to their lack of knowledge regarding, well, or bullshitting capability more than anything, because, you know, how can you lose track of that? And it's not the point that it's, you know, not radioactive or dangerous in the quantity that it's in. You know, this could happen to anything else, or, you know, what are they hiding? What's going on here?
Yeah, just come out and tell. And don't make these statements that you have absolutely no foundation in, as in, it's not a terrorist threat. Well, bull hockey, you don't know what it is, so don't say that. And one of the things I wanted to point out on this is that this antimony 124 will cause skin ulcers, lethal if ingested, and it's used actually in some chemotherapies. So they said that these vials that this stuff is in is 50% full of a sand-like substance. Now, I don't know enough to know if the antimony is the sand-like substance or if that is some kind of media that they suppressed it in within these vials. I don't know. But they said, don't touch it and don't open it. Yeah, no. Okay.
Well, that's a really interesting story, and it really shows the idiocy of government agencies.
Yeah. Just another related story on that, which, as far as amount of stuff that could be missing, is a couple of magnitudes greater. We have a member on ATS, Aristoi, and please forgive me now if I botched that. He gives a report out of the San Francisco Chronicle that possibly 600 plus pounds of plutonium could be missing from the Los Alamos facility. And once again, the Federal Bureau of Health has said, no, it's not missing. It's just an accounting error. In other words, it's missing. You know?
Well, basically, yeah, but, you know, in other words, you know, and, you know, if they're making a reassuring statement, people might take it that way.
Man. So that's something we probably ought to keep up with, because I would think that 600 pounds of plutonium could cause some issues. He gives a statement here. The first bomb dropped in World War II had 13 pounds in it. Happy!
Wow. And I think most of us are familiar with the amount of damage that did.
Yeah, that was nothing.
Wow.
Well, I think we've got a lot of great things to keep up with here. The WEAST thing is really getting interesting.
Well, and I think the sad thing is that it seems to have come to its conclusion. And beyond the sentencing part, there might be very difficult to find information on it, but I'm definitely going to keep trying, because that last article's really got me curious again. So instead of satisfying, it's piqued my curiosity.
I know. And with it at a conclusion, this may be the first time that I ever get to get involved in an FOIA. We might have to do a request. At least we'll learn the process.
Yeah. And we'll definitely be keeping up with the avian flu in Indonesia. And, you know, on a larger scale, we'll be watching it anyway. And if anything comes up, we'll be bringing it to you.
And I think with that, we're going to say goodnight and go medicate ourselves against the evil attacks of the other people.
It might be more difficult for you, though.
I know.
And also, just a heads up, watch out for AT Estrogen Light coming soon.
Oh, that's right.
It'll be our attempt at fun with conspiracy subjects.
Yay.
And we'll be in between our more serious shows like these. So, with that, we'll be saying goodnight. Thanks for listening.
Goodnight.
Bye.
Bye.